Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio's Good Growing with the Garden Guy, affectionately known as the Garden Guy. Okay. With Gary Heilig.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, welcome back. And we have my sister Sue. She's on the road there down in Kalamazoo. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you. I'm glad that I'm still here.
Oh, good. Why don't you lead us with a word of prayer?
Okay. Heavenly Father, thank you that we're able to stay warm and toasty in this chilly season while we're thinking about what we should choose to grow and upcome, that you have invented and created, and things we don't know yet, but things to teach us and help us to make wise choices so that we can learn ourselves and share that with other people, and that makes us learn more about you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Amen. Well, Gary, you gave us a wide, big path here. You have root crops. Now, that doesn't give me too many hints.
Well, you know what root crops are, right?
Yeah, you know, carrots. Okay. and beets.
Yeah, that's what the quiz is on today.
Yes, turnips and rutabaggy.
So your first question is, and I'm going to keep a tally. I think you won last time, didn't you, Tom?
It was one of those rare occasions.
The first one is, which of the following vegetables is a true botanical root rather than a modified stem? Is it potatoes? Is it ginger? Is it carrot or onions?
I think carrots.
What do you think, Tom?
I don't know much about ginger, so I'll go with carrots.
Have you ever seen it grow, ginger?
I did not know.
Yeah, it grows on the surface.
Oh, okay.
And it is carrots. So
okay.
Both of you get a point.
Okay.
All right, number two. This is a simple true and false question. Sweet potatoes and yams are botanically the same crop. True or false?
False.
False.
It's definitely false. They don't even look the same. next one is multiple choice. Number three. Which root crop was a major food source for ancient Andean civilizations and has been cultivated for over 5,000 years? Is it beets, turnips, potatoes, or radishes?
Potatoes.
Potatoes sounds like a good choice.
Is that your final answer?
Yes.
All right. You both got it.
Okay.
Yeah, that was pretty
Yay!
Easy.
Yay!
All right. So the next one is also multiple choice. What pigment gives beets their deep red color, which also acts as a powerful antioxidant? Is it anthocyanins, lycopene, betalain, or keratin?
It's not keratin.
Keratin.
You think it's keratin?
Yep, keratin.
Keratin is also in carrots.
I know that.
So are you sure you want to go with that answer?
No. That first one... You've used it in various other descriptions.
Anthocyanins.
Anthocyanins. I've got to go with the A word.
What about you, Sue?
I'm still, the anthocyanin is, I don't know, but I kind of think I want to stick with the beta carotene.
No, neither one of you had it. It's the betalain. Betalain.
Okay.
Anthocyanin is a redder pigment. But the keratin is the yellow pigments.
Right.
So we were talking about the red color, but beets do come in an orange color, and they probably have more keratin in them. But in this particular case, it's the betalain. Okay, this one is true and false. You're still tied up at three. Carrots were originally purple or yellow, not orange. True or false?
True.
That sounds like a true question.
And that would be correct. You guys are still tied.
Isn't it that the Dutch developed the orange carrot to honor their king, William of Orange?
Sounds like a good idea, but I don't know for sure, Sue. I'd have to double check that one. But it sounds like an interesting idea. I don't even know who did most of the early breeding on carrots, so I can't answer that question. Okay, which root crop is especially high in indolin, which is a prebiotic fiber that supports gut health? Is it the carrot or parsnips? Or Jerusalem artichokes, also called sunchokes, or radishes?
Oh, I'm going with the parsnippies.
Okay, you're going with the parsnips? All right, I'm gonna give you a little bit of an advantage here.
Okay.
If you want to go ahead, pick something else. Now I owe one for Sue.
There you are. What'd you choose, Sue?
Parsnippies.
So it's beets, turnips, parsnips, Jerusalem artichokes. Carrots was the first one.
Let's go with artichokes.
And you would be correct. It's Jerusalem artichokes. And
I thought it would be parsnips.
Mm. Yeah, I remember that one because when I used to teach Master Gardener, they suggest Jerusalem artichokes as a substitute for potatoes because you don't get the raise of your blood sugar from indolin like you do with potatoes. Okay, so the next one is, which root crop played a significant role in preventing scurvy due to its vitamin C content? Rutabagas, potatoes, beets, or turnips?
I gotta say potatoes. The potatoes have some vitamin C, as I recall.
What are you thinking, Sue?
I think that that's true, but what are the other choices again?
Rutabaga, potato, beets, turnips.
I'm tempted by the potatoes because I know they do have some, but seems like
sometimes you just have to yield to temptation.
maybe beets.
Oh, I was trying to give you a hint. That's why I said yield to temptation on this one, nothing else. It's potatoes. Oh, Tom has gone into a 2-point lead here, Sue. You're going to have to come back, but you have plenty of time. Okay, this one's true and false. All root crops store energy primarily in the form of starches.
I'll say true.
True.
Actually, it's false.
We both missed that one.
Yeah, some store sugars. Notice, when you hear things like all,
yes,
or always or never, really look closely at that and think about what you're going to answer. So nobody got anything there. The next one is,
should have remembered the sugar beets, Tom.
That's right.
Yeah.
We should have remembered all those sugar beets grown in Michigan.
Because they store sugars.
Now, this one got me, too, when I first looked at it. Which root crop is traditionally fermented to make kimchi? Is it turnips, daikon, which is a type of radish, C, which is both A and B, or the last one, D, is carrots?
What was the one between the daikon and the carrots?
You get both B, A and B, which would be both turnip and daikon.
Oh, I see. Okay. I daikon is kind of popular, and some of the kimchi is kind of fiery, so I think I'm going to go with that one.
What do you think, Tom? Is it turnips, daikon, both turnips and daikon, or carrots?
I'll go with C, which is A and B.
And Tom has gone out into a 3-point lead.
Oh, no!
Yeah, when you see that double choice, look closely. All right, number 10. The next one is, what is the primary reason root crops are well adapted to cooler climates? Is it that they photosynthesize underground, they require less water, the edible portion is insulated by soil, or they grow only in winter? Well, we can eliminate one right away.
I'm going to go for the insulated plan.
What is yours, Tom?
I like the insulated one also.
And you're both correct on that one.
There's particularly important in those northern regions where that's some of the few crops that they can grow with a very short growing season.
Okay, you're going to have to really make a move here. Sue, you're a number. We have number 11. You only have 4 more chances. And so here we go. This is true and false. Parsnips develop better flavor after exposure to a frost. True or false?
After what?
Parsnips develop better flavor after exposure to a frost. True or false?
True or false? Yeah, I think that could be true.
What do you think, Tom?
I'll also say true.
Okay, you're both right on that one.
Yay!
Okay, Sue, you're running out of time. And multiple choice again. Which of the following is classified as a tuberous root rather than a true root or stem tuber? Is it a potato, an onion, sweet potato, or garlic? Which one of those would be called a tuberous root?
I think the sweet potato.
I'm choosing sweet potato also.
And you both would be right. We talked about onion was a modified stem, potatoes a modified stem, and garlic. Yeah, that's modified stem also because the roots are below. So, sweet potato's the right answer. And Tom still has a 3-point lead.
Oh, Sue, at this point, it's painful.
You can't win, even if Tom completely falls on his face. Okay, the next one is true and false. Root crops generally require loose, well-drained soil to develop straight, well-formed roots. True or false?
I think that can be true.
I'm going to say false just to be...
Well, there goes the first trip on Tom's part. So you're down by two now.
So they do need to have the loose soil.
Yeah, they will form the best shape, whatever shape they're trying to get, if the soil's more loose.
They're and not fighting against
If the... you grew up in Saginaw where I did, where we grew things in heavy clay soil, yeah. You'd have caught that one in a hurry.
Okay.
All right, the last question is, which root crop was introduced to Europe in the 18th century and later became a major source of sugar? Is it the carrot, the turnip, the sugar beet, or the parsnip?
We're going to go with sugar beet.
What, yeah, I think the sugar beet.
And I think you would be both right. So you ended up, Tom, again, 2 months in a row. Sue?
Gonna have to polish my record.
We're gonna have to give you a participation trophy today. No, you guys did really well. You got a lot of points. So let's see, how much did Sue got? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. You got 11 out of 15, Tom.
Oh.
That's pretty good, buddy.
All right. Hey, Gary, Why don't we take a break here a little early, and then we'll talk about the All-American selection winners. We can't wait.
Okay.
We'll be right back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeur, and Tom Majeur.
This is Ruthie Calkins from Tustin. The Bible tells us that heaven will be the dwelling place of God's friends. That's why I'm so excited about supporting Strong Tower Radio. Their unique blend of thought-provoking speakers, stirring inspirational messages, and heartwarming music reaches into the lives and hearts of each listener, helping them to develop and cherish a friendship with God. If this radio station has been a blessing to you and your family, why not join me and hundreds of others in supporting Strong Tower Radio with a financial gift? They're 100% listener supported and could really use your help right now. You can send your check to Strong Tower Radio, Post Office Box 567, Cadillac, Michigan 49601. Or you can visit their secure website to use your credit card at strongtowerradio.org. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Sue Majeur, and Tom Majeur. We did the root quiz the last first segment, and now we're going to talk about the 2026 All-American Selection winners. Gary, remind our listeners what the All-American Selection winners are.
Well, what they are is it's a private company, and seed companies from all over the world will take their newest varieties and they send them in for testing. And there are both display gardens and trial gardens all over the United States and Canada. And the display gardens are past All-America Selection winners plus similar varieties. And the trial gardens are where the latest varieties are trialed for 2 years to see if they will be good enough to be released in the trade. And what they look for is the characteristics that homeowners would appreciate. It might be a new color. It might be disease resistance. It may be a longer blooming period or repeat blooming. It might be something that spreads really nicely. So there's all kinds of characteristics that people would look for in gardening. And they have judges. We had a trial garden and a display garden at Michigan State University. And there was a doctor named Lowell Ewart who was the person that would keep all the statistics. And usually they had a field day, and all the judges from around the country would go to all the gardens and they would evaluate all of these. Then they'd get together and decide which ones would receive an award. Mm. And so this year there were 15 award winners, and I think that's the most that I've ever heard of since I started being involved in this. And I used to grow them when I worked in a greenhouse at MSU. So I've never seen this many winners. But the first one is a zinnia, and it's an annual. It's called Profusion Double White. So obviously you can tell what color it is. And this one is a gold medal winner.
Okay.
And the gold medal winners are flowers that are head and shoulders above the other winners in terms of, and I'll talk a little bit more about it as we go through this, but you don't get a gold medal winner very often. And I've gone years without seeing a gold medal winner. So maybe 5-6 years before you'll see one again, unless they come up with something really great. Now, this one gets up to about 18 inches tall, about 14 inches wide. It'll produce flowers up to 3 inches across, and they're white. And one of the reasons they like them, it's continuous bloom. And one of the reasons it was selected, too, was exceptional disease resistance. And anybody that's ever grown zinnias know that when it gets warm around August and humid, you get powdery mildew. And if you get a really heavy infection, the plants will go down pretty quickly. But this one is resistant to that. Also, another thing that a lot of people have to do with zinnias and other plants similar to it is you have to deadhead them, which means that when the flowers are spent, you take them off. If you don't do that, they'll produce seeds, and it sends chemical messages to the rest of the plant to stop producing more flowers. Well, this one you don't have to deadhead, and it'll continue to bloom. and it will be available as seed, so you can grow this one yourself at home. The next one is a coreopsis, and it's called Sun Globe. And I like to grow coreopsis because birds like their seeds, especially yellow finches. So it attracts birds. And this one also won a national award. And what national award means is that they'll grow well no matter where you are in the country. Like, we're in the Great Lakes area. But there are the southeast and the southwest and northeast. So they divide the country up into regions. And sometimes certain ones will grow best in a particular region. And it doesn't mean that if it's northeast, you can't grow it. It's just it will not perform as well as if it was in the northeast. So anyway, this coreopsis only gets to be about 14 inches tall, between 10 to 14 inches. And it has semi-double flowers. And of course, all coreopsis are pretty much yellow in terms of their color. And it will start to bloom early summer and will continue to bloom in fall. But when it blooms, it's a heavy rebloom, which means with a lot of coreopsis, you'll get blooming over time, but it won't be very much. There'll be flowers here and there. But this one is a very heavy rebloomer. And sometimes coreopsis doesn't do very well in heavy heat, but this one's very heat tolerant. So you'll like that. Another one.
Nice. That's nice. I've always been fond of, like, the moonbeam because I like the feathery foliage.
Mm-hmm.
And the flowers are cute, but I love the idea that it won't go so tall and just flop over like some do.
And this one, being only 10 to 14 inches, you're not going to have that problem. And you will be able to buy this one from seed also. Sometimes they only offer plants, and there's one in here that you can only get plants. But
what does the petals look like of this coreopsis?
Coreopsis petals are a little bit elongated. They're not real thick.
Look more like a daisy, or
I'm trying to remember. Yes, sort of like it, but not quite. It's kind of hard to describe what they look like, because when you describe a leaf, if you're going to do it right, there are certain shapes and there's certain botanical terms that they'll use, like obtuse and or spaded shape or whatever. And I just don't remember what terms to use for that. So, you know, I'm 71, going to be 72 pretty soon, so I don't remember all my botany that I used to know. But anyway, the next one is a dianthus, and it's called Super Rose Picote. And the picote simply means that it has a two-tiered color system. The edge is one color and the middle is another color. And this one isn't very tall either. It only gets 8 to 10 inches tall. It gets a little wider, up to 12 inches wide. And the blooms are fringed, and they'll get up to 2 inches across. This one takes up to 85 days if you start it from seed. So, and again, it blooms from summer into the early fall, very heat tolerant, very compact, and the coloration is quite vivid. It's, if I remember correctly, it's kind of a white center with a reddish, not quite burgundy, but a darker red edging to it. And you can buy this one by seeds also. The next one's
about fragrance, Gary?
They didn't mention fragrance as a reason for selecting it as an award winner, so I would not think that it has much of a fragrance. So the next one is a perennial. It's a sedum. And this one also won a national award, just like all the previous ones won national awards. This one gets a little taller, 18 to 22 inches, and get up to 2 feet wide. And the flowers are kind of pinkish in a flat, large cluster that will be about 4 to 6 inches across. And it will bloom the first season you grow it from seed, which that's not the case with all perennials. And this one blooms from midsummer on into the fall. And what they really liked about this one is that the stems, being fairly tall, almost 2 feet tall, they're very much upright. They don't flop over. And it's a really good plant for attracting pollinators. And you'll be able to buy the seeds, which many times the perennials, they may only be available as plants. The next one is Heliopsis, which is sunflower family, and or I should say sunflower genus. And this one's also a perennial. It's called Sol, I guess it's Giotto. And this one won a national award also. So all of these that we've talked about so far will grow equally well anywhere in the country. It'll get up to about 3 feet tall, about 2 feet wide as a cluster. And it has, obviously, the heliopsis have daisy-like flowers. And this one, being a perennial, will also bloom the first year from seed. And it has a very long blooming season, excellent heat tolerator, great for attracting pollinators. And you'll be able to, it says it's going to be available for seed and as perennial plants. And there's more. These are all flowers. We haven't even gotten to the vegetables
about
yet.
About one third of the way.
Yeah. The next one is a Rebecca. It's called Claire. And it was selected because it has a bright orange blooms. The plants are very uniform, strong branching, and you can get these as seeds and plants. I would look for seeds first, and when you go to the All America Selection website, they should tell you what companies will carry them, because finding a company that's carrying them in the first year as plants might be a little tough. Not all greenhouses will get all the new stuff right away. And this one, the flowers can be up to 4 inches across, between 3 and 4 inches across. So that's a pretty good sized flower. And this one also blooms summer to early fall. Then the next one is also an annual. This one's an annual, and as well as a Rebecca. And this is a Celosia. Mm-hmm. And this, there are two different types of Celosias. There's like a fan type, and then there's a plumosa type, which looks like a feathery plume. And this one is the feathery plumes, and they can get 6 to 8 inches. And the plant size can get up to 18 inches tall. So it's a pretty good size for Celosia. And it's called Flama Pink, so you can tell what the color is. And this one will bloom summer through frost, very heat tolerant, very vivid color. And a lot of times, Celosias are picked because they don't lose their color right away. Some Celosias, the color washes out as they get older. Mm-hmm. And usually the ones that win the All-America selections will hold their color better. And, of course, this one's a great cut flower also. And you can dry it. And it'll be available as seeds and plants. But, again, you'll probably want to start to grow that one yourself. And the last one that we have is a dahlia, also a national winner. All the flowers were national winners, so... the plant size gets to be about 3 feet tall, which dahlias can get quite tall, depending on what type you grow, up to 2 feet wide. And the color is a deep ruby red blooms, which can be 3 to 4 inches across. They do take a while to produce. They bloom about 90 to 100 days from planting, so you want to start these early if you can. You're not going to start them from seed. And then they bloom from... summer on into the fall until they get frost. And they like them because they had dark foliage, very strong stems, and a high flower count for a dahlia. And these will only be available as plants. A lot of times you'll buy dahlias as tubers. I would say watch online to see if you can find the tubers. But
are they double or single?
It didn't say they were double, so they're probably single. But they may be kind of hard to find because they are so new. The next ones are vegetables, and we do have some herbs also. And there's one basil called Treviso. It also won a national one. And it's not very tall. It's about 10 to 14 inches tall. And it takes about 2 months to harvest from transplants, about 90 days if you direct seed it in the ground. I like to start things in pots, but my wife likes to sow her seeds directly into the garden. And once you start harvesting, it's just continuous. And you don't have to wait for them to get their full size in order to start harvesting. You can just clip off what you want, and it'll keep growing. And
are these suitable for kitchen windowsills? Like if you want to have a potted herb so you can just pluck some when you're cooking?
Oh, I don't see why not, because it's only 10 to 14 inches tall. So, yeah, you should be able to do that easily. You could grow them outside during the summer months and then bring them in. You just want to be sure that you don't bring in aphids with it because, for instance, I brought in a jalapeno pepper. I wanted to overwinter it, and it's covered with aphids right now, so I've got to get rid of those guys. They picked this one because it's really compact and it's slow bolting. And what that means is a lot of times when it gets really hot and dry, plants will go from the vegetative state, which is what we want with a basil, to the reproductive state where it produces flowers and seeds. Now, if you want flowers and seeds, bolting's not a problem. But if you want green tissue, bolting is a problem. This one is resistant to bolting and has very tender leaves. They rate it as having excellent flavor. And there's nothing I like better than putting some fresh basil on a brand new pizza that I just made. Mm-hmm. So, well, we'll be trying that one.
Oh, they're delicious in sandwiches instead of lettuce. Oh, Tom and Brenda taught me that. Basil instead of lettuce is so tasty.
Now, I mentioned gold medal winners, and there's a vegetable that's a gold medal winner, and it's a kale.
Mm.
And it's called ruby boar. Ruby and then B-O-R. And a little bit more about the All-America gold medal. It has to be something that's fairly new to the market. And also, they tested in multiple independent trial gardens across North America. It's compared with all the others that are out there. Usually they're looking for better yield, better bloom, stronger disease resistance, improved flavor and color, more uniform growth, all of these things which we talked about a little bit earlier. And as I said, it's fairly rare to get this designation, but this particular one, the kale, won it. And it doesn't get that tall. It only gets to be about 18 inches tall, about 2 feet wide. You can harvest it from seed in 50 to 60 days. Of course, with kale, you can harvest baby leaves at any time you want. And it's outstanding because it has a deep purple foliage, which means it has lots of antioxidants in it. The leaves are very tender, and it can be used both as an ornamental because of its purple reddish color, and it's definitely edible. So it will be available as seeds. We normally don't start kale as a transplant. I mean, I guess you could, but there's just no reason because it doesn't take that long. It's only 50 to 60 days. But this one I'll be looking for.
Is this a ruffled kale, or is it more like the lactiato kale?
I would call it semi-ruffled when I looked at the picture of it. It's not like smooth leaf or anything, but just it's not totally ruffled like you see some of the kales. So it's kind of in between. And I'm definitely trying this one because kale is probably one of the most nutritious vegetables that you can grow. And delicious, too.
Yeah, I got an observation. We have our two types of kale in the greenhouse. And it seems like the curly kale is weathering the cold weather a little bit better than the dinosaur kale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, are you talking about the real long one? That the one they use to dry and people eat kale, dried kale?
That's possible.
I think that's the one that they dry for that.
But it was just interesting. I assumed all kales.
No, because I think that one you're talking about is a thinner leaf, mm-hmm. whereas the other one is much thicker, like not quite as thick as cabbage, but it's a much thicker leaf. And, of course, kale's flavor will improve with a light frost, too. So I probably would harvest some during the season and try it, and then harvest some after it's had a slight frost and see if you notice much of a difference, but you should. There were two basils that won this year also. The second one was called Piedmont, also a national winner. This one gets a little taller. It gets up to 2 feet tall. And harvest time is 65 to 75 days from seed. And very large leaves, classic Italian basil flavor. And it'll also be available as seeds. Now, there was one other one that was a tomato, and I don't like the name of it. It's called Bada Bing.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, this one is a determinate tomato, which means that it grows up to a certain point and terminates. Mm-hmm. Indeterminate means by the end of the season, you might have a vine that would be 6 to 8 feet long. And it makes very small, they call saladette, I guess I call it just a cherry tomato. And it's 50 to 60 days after transplant. And it really sets a heavy crop. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try this one this year. They said it has excellent flavor. It's crack resistant, which a lot of the cherry small tomatoes will crack if they stay on too long. And it says it has a strong disease-resistant package. Now, I don't know what they mean by package, but that must mean multiple disease-resistant. So that'll be interesting to try. Now, disease-resistant doesn't mean it won't get any disease. It simply means that it won't get as heavy a load of disease as something that has lower disease resistance, like Brandywine tomato, which is a heritage type. If you don't spray that for various fungal diseases, it'll just get tore up.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we're going to try that one this year. Then there was a cauliflower that won this year, and it's called Murasky. Reto. I don't know where that name came from. This also was a national winner, and it's about a 70-day cauliflower, and cauliflower is mostly grown midsummer to fall. And this one has purple florets, and also the stems are edible. And it says it has a sweet, nutty flavor, very heat tolerant, which means you don't have the buttoning as much. Buttoning is when the cauliflower gets stressed and it produces a curd, but the curd stays small.
Okay.
And you don't have to blanch it. Well, obviously, if it's purple, you don't have to blanch it, because we only really blanch the white cultivars. And blanching, for those who don't know what it is, that means you take the outer leaves and put it up around the developing curd, and then you tie it up there so that the sun can't get to the curd, and that keeps it nice and white. But for purple, why would you do that? And then there's one more. It's called Majesty, and it's a pole bean. Now, this one is a regional winner, but it is a regional winner for Great Lakes and West and Northwest. So it'll grow just fine here. And it has 6 to 8 foot vines, so it's indeterminate. It's a pole bean. And you can harvest it 55 to 65 days from seed. And they considered it outstanding because it has very high yields, assuming that you continue to pick, very sweet pods, excellent stress tolerance. And so you might want to try that one. So I'll be looking for these, and hopefully we can talk about them at the end of the year. And, oh, I'm sorry, there's one more.
Okay.
But this one is a regional winner, not for the Great Lakes area. It's northeast, southeast, mountain, and southwest. And it's a butternut squash, but it's called Butter Lamp. And it's fairly small. It's only 1 to 2 pound mini fruits. And this one, the vine is short, only 3 to 5 feet, so that would save you some space. Ready in 80 to 90 days. And you can buy this as seeds or transplants also.
Very good. When we come back, we're going to talk about micronutrients and a little bit about apples. So stay tuned. This is Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Tom Majeur, and Sue Majeur.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
3-2-1. We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. We're going to be talking about plant nutrients, micronutrients.
And macro.
Macro, okay.
And secondary. So just as a quick recap, because we've talked about the nutrients before, the three biggest nutrients that they need are nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. Those what you see the big three numbers on any bag of fertilizer. Then we have the secondary nutrients, which means they're needed in smaller amounts, which would be calcium, magnesium, and sulfur.
Okay.
And then the micronutrients would be things like iron, manganese, boron, zinc, copper, molybdenum, chlorine, and nickel. So that, I think that's like 15. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Not 14. There must be another one somewhere, because okay. I thought there were 15. And the micronutrients are required in very small amounts. For instance, if you were a farmer and you were going to plant an acre of something, and they might say something like you need 90 pounds per acre of nitrogen. Whereas if you were putting on manganese, you might only need 1 pound per acre. And an acre is 43,560 square feet, so it's a pretty big area. And secondary obviously would be in between those two. But one that I wanted to do is focus on calcium this time. We've done a number of the others in the past, but I wanted to talk a little bit about what calcium is used for. And it contributes to the structural component. Now, you might remember when we talked about cells.
Mm-hmm.
Cells in animals like us are different than the cells that you have in plants. Plants have what we call rigid cell walls. So they're hard, essentially.
Okay.
We have
They're more structural.
Right. And we have more rigid, they're not less rigid ones, they're softer. And one of the structural components that give them that strong rigidness is calcium. And calcium is also necessary for both shoot development and root development in the plant. It also plays a role in regulating how the plants take nutrients out of the soil and then transport them to various parts of the plant. And there's a chemical called enzymes. And enzymes are what they do. They're materials that will get things going, physiological processes. And calcium will activate these enzymes, will then cause various other things to happen in plant growth. And I'm trying to keep it kind of simple, because we could take up the whole segment just talking about one aspect of that. And also, calcium is important in terms of the quality of the seeds that are produced in the plant. And also, it can prevent certain disorders, like when people get blossom end rot on their tomatoes, mm-hmm. where the bottom rots. Yeah. That's actually a calcium deficiency. And calcium is not a very mobile material in the plant. There's certain nutrients that when the plant's growing, and if there's not enough in the soil, they'll take it from other parts of the plant and ship it to the new growth parts. And then you start to have deficiencies in the places where the material is taken from.
Mm-hmm.
And calcium is one of those. If you don't have enough calcium in the fruit, it's not very mobile, and so you start to develop a deficiency in the fruit. Also, the places where you get calcium primarily is from things like limestone, or people will add gypsum to the soil. They usually add it, and they'll say, oh, this will break up all the soil, but that doesn't really work well in Michigan. Or dolomitic limestone, like if the soil test tells you you need to put some limestone on your garden, calcium is in that. And there are forms that are water soluble. For instance, if you want to spray it on the leaves, like calcium nitrate or calcium chloride, calcium sulfate, and of course calcium sulfate will tend to acidify the soil and lower the pH. And then there are organic sources of calcium. And one is crushed egg shells and bone meal. And one of the things I do now is I save my egg shells, and my wife bought me an old blender from, I think it was a secondhand store.
Mm-hmm.
And so I let the eggshells dry out, and then I have to cover the blender over because it really blends it fine into a powder, and the stuff will fly all over the place, even with the top on it. And you can go on... you can go on your computer and ask ChatGPT, for instance, what is the analysis of eggshells? In other words, what nutrients are you adding?
Mm-hmm.
And so I will take that and I'll spread it onto my garden, and it'll be a source of calcium. Also, it's rare, but you can have calcium deficiencies, and we talked about an example of that with blossom end rot. But if it's really bad, you can get curled or stunted leaves, the young ones especially. And you can also get blossom end rot in peppers and eggplant also. It's not as common, but it can happen. Root development can be really poor. You can get what's called chip burn in lettuce, which it looks like is dying back. That can be a calcium deficiency. That can happen on cabbage also. And sometimes if it's really bad, which... I would not expect to see this in Michigan, but if it's really bad, you'll see necrotic spots, which are dead areas in young leaves as they develop. You can get a toxicity, but, you know, unless you were liming and putting a lot of eggshells on, you're not likely to run into that. But it can interfere, if you get too much calcium in the soil, with the uptake of other nutrients like magnesium, potassium, and manganese. So you can put on too much of a good thing. So you don't want to be unreasonable about it. But when, as we said, you can apply it in various forms, like the calcium in fertilizers, the liquid materials, and foliar sprays if you need to. But most of the time, people don't need to know that, don't need to worry about that. If you maintain a pH of your soil between 6 and 7, which is about right for most vegetables, then most likely you're not going to have any calcium problems. So it's an interesting little nutrient. It is necessary to have around, though.
Absolutely. Let's talk about apples. You've had a great question here. Why... apple trees survive Michigan winters, but not oranges.
Well, as we know, apple trees are deciduous trees, which means they drop their leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And they go into dormancy during the winter months. And when they go into dormancy, they're not dead. There are certain metabolic processes that are still going on, but they're really slowed down. And one of the things that happens when they're going into dormancy is water moves out of the soil. Mm-hmm. Inside a cell, we have something called cytoplasm, which is a mixture of different things, sugars and water and other things that the plant needs to carry on its metabolic processes. But when it starts to go into dormancy, the water is driven out of the cell, not all of it, but quite a bit of it, and it stays in between the cells. And that helps to prepare it for the freezing temperatures. And we'll get a little bit more into that in a little while. But
because if it was internal, it would damage the cells. But
if there's too much water in there, yeah, it could.
And so it's interspatial.
Right. The freezing in between the cells is not as bad as freezing inside the cells. Because what happens when water freezes?
It expands and it would burst the cell.
That's right, walls. Because the cell's not flexible. It's very rigid. So it can only hold so much pressure and then it bursts. And now an orange tree, for instance, is an evergreen, which means that it doesn't have a dormancy period. It grows year-round. That's not going to work in Michigan. And so it keeps its leaves. It has sap flowing and the tissue is more tender. So once you get down below freezing, the water freezes in the cell, and then it bursts the cell, and then, of course, the leaves will turn black, and the wood is damaged, and 28 degrees for a certain period of time can do some serious damage to a citrus tree. Now, the interesting thing also about apples is that as they go into dormancy, the cell wall actually thickens, which makes it tougher. And another thing happens is that plants produce starches. And we know that when an apple is ripening, It has a lot of starch. And then as it ripens, it develops sugars. Fructose is the biggest sugar. Well, when it goes into dormancy, a lot of those starches that are in the wood and of the plant, they're converted to sugars. And what that does when it's in the cytoplasm, in the cell, it freezes at a lower temperature than if it was just pure water.
It's more of an antifreeze.
So, yeah, it's like an antifreeze. And actually, the biggest antifreeze in apples is a sugar called sorbitol. Have you ever heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
It's an artificial sweetener. Yeah. And so that is one of the antifreeze compounds. And also there's certain proteins that act as antifreeze, and also certain amino acids like proline is an amino acid. So it toughens up the plant. That doesn't happen in oranges. And the cells do shrink a little bit, but they stay intact. Now, another thing that's different about the trees themselves is the wood itself.
Okay.
In the sense of the apple tree has a dense, hardened wood. It's thicker. And it also has a thicker bark, and that bark acts as an insulator. Whereas I've grown some orange trees, and the bark is very thin. And also, when you look at the wood, it's softer and it has more moisture in it compared to apples, especially when you get into the dormant season. Also, the apple trees have bud covers, sort of like little blankets, and they're able to keep that bud a little bit more protected, whereas oranges have no protection on their buds. So when they're exposed to cold temperatures, they're just fried. And like I said, the bark is much thinner. So there are some differences. And one of the things I decided to do is I asked ChatGPT, I said, could we genetically manipulate
an
orange tree to have the characteristics of the apple tree, and that you'd be able to grow oranges in Michigan? You know what it said?
I don't know.
Not likely.
Okay.
Because what it said is they haven't identified all the genes that control all of these things, first of all. And they suspect there are multiple genes that will affect all of these different processes. So they might be able to improve the hardiness of citrus over time so that it could move further north. Because, like, citrus doesn't grow further north than Orlando. And that's kind of north.
Iffy.
You really need to be further south because they do get some cold weather sometime. But it's highly unlikely that you would ever be able to grow it in Michigan because, first of all, it's an evergreen. And it's just not going to do anything under our cold temperatures. But they might be able to do some genetic manipulation that will make them a little bit more hardy. And they're doing some work now to try to do something about the citrus. What do they call that? It's a new disease in citrus. It's been around for a few years, but it's just wiping out citrus trees. Mm. Citrus greening is what it's called.
Well, just one last question here is can we grow apples in the South? And if not, why not?
No, you can't. And the reason is plants up north require what's called a chilling period. And apples, for instance, require 800 to 1600 hours in temperatures being between 32 and 45.
Mm.
And that's only about 12 to 12 to 26 days of those temperatures in order for it to be able to produce fruit. So I did a little digging into it to find out what actually happens that allows this to, that requires this cool period. First of all, we get to the shorter days and the cooler temperatures. And what the plant does is it produces a blocking hormone called abscisic acid. Remember, we've talked about that before. Abscisic acid is also the hormone responsible for developing...
Cutting off the thing for the leaves to drop.
Right. The abscission layer between the leaf petiole and the stem, which allows the leaves to fall and also for the fruit to come off. But what happens is the abscisic acid starts to go up as it gets into dormancy, and that puts a break on the ability of the plant to come out of dormancy. And over the course of the winter months, the levels of abscisic acid go down. And when it goes into this dormancy, it's called endodormancy, where the abscisic acid levels get up to a certain point. And then once it gets down to a certain point, it goes into what's called ectodormancy, where the buds can grow if they have the proper trigger. And again, hormones play a role in that, both gibberellins and cytokinins, which we've talked about once before. And we won't get into the detail of how they work because it would just take us too long. But then it becomes a factor of temperature. Once the abscisic acid levels are low enough, the buds are ready. They just have to have the right temperature. And then as the temperature goes up, then they start to grow. And if you try to grow these plants in the south, where they don't get the cooling, what you'll get is buds that will open and leaves that will come out sporadically. And the flowers, when they develop, some of them will be sterile. And it's just, it causes problems for the plants. So
absolutely.
It's really interesting to see how this stuff works.
I have a question that's sort of, it's kind of a part of this. When Tom and Brenda lived in southern Illinois, there was an apple. They would go out to a local orchard and they would pick. And there was a lovely apple there called Golden Blush. It was a beautiful yellow apple, and then where the sun would touch it through things, it would get a red cheek, you mm-hmm. know,
yeah.
on there. It was very sweet. It was a very delicious apple. Not a long keeper like a wine sap, but very, very tasty and sweet. We can't grow them here. And conversely, like some of the, like one of the heirloom varieties, which you don't find in the store, you have to go to an orchard find, like Northern Spies.
Mm-hmm.
Grandma loved those. They make good pies, and they're good for eating out of hand. But they couldn't grow the Northern Spies down there. They're both apples, and they're both, quote, northern compared to Florida, obviously. But what makes that little difference in the same genus there that we can't grow the Golden Blush and they can't grow the Northern Spies?
I'll have to look and see what I can find out about Golden Blush, but there is differences in hardiness between apple varieties. For instance, if you were to look at the recommendations for apple varieties from Minnesota, which gets really mm-hmm. cold, it's a much smaller list than what we can grow here in Michigan.
Well, that's quite a topic here, and we've completed another program of Good Growing with the Garden Guy. Thank you again, Gary.
It's been fun.
And Sue?
Yes, indeedy.
Until next time, Good Growing with the Garden Guy. We'll be back in February. Bye now.